Aloha, and welcome back to Zoopedia and our continued trek through the story of our national parks. My name is Zach Zoo, and I can't wait to dive into part 4, where we get to see how the dynamic duo of Stephen Mather and Horace Albright continue on their trailblazing adventure of glory into further developing the National Park Service. Before that, let's get the Zoopedia fun fact of the week out of the way. Did you know that recycling one glass jar saves enough energy to watch television for 3 hours? Make sure you recycle, and do your part in slowing down the destruction of the planet. The average person has the chance to recycle 25,000 cans in their lifetime. That's 75,000 hours of television. And with that 75,000 hours of television, you could rewatch The Queen's Gambit 11,450 times. Honestly, definitely one of the best shows I've ever seen. Potentially, arguably, the best show I've ever seen. It's on Netflix. Do yourself a favor and give it a watch. But after this episode. Before we jump into part 4, let's go into a very brief recap. As y'all remember, we got acquainted with the legendary philanthropic marketing millionaire Mr. Stephen Mather after his claim to fame from his legendary borax company. Soon after, we were introduced to Horace Albright, and we witnessed the phenomenal tag team action that these two were thrust into by their passionate will for preserving nature and extending the bountiful glories of the national parks to the American people. We witnessed extreme highs as Mather and Albright explored national parks all throughout the country and made sure the parks were being taken care of while also experiencing their awe-inspiring wonder. We witnessed extreme lows when Mather succumbed to a deep depression after establishing his dream of a national park service and leaving Albright to fend for himself with only a dream of what could be, being his sole guiding force in further establishing the park service. We witnessed a hero's comeback with Mather returning to head the reins of the park service after being rejuvenated by witnessing the beauty of Zion in Utah and getting the Grand Canyon designated as a national park. It is here where we left off on the journey of our heroes, 5 years after the National Park Service was established, and 4 years after Mather's tenure as head of the service was supposed to end. With new energy, endless ideas, and an extenuating passion for the parks and people, we ride on into part 4 of the battle for our national parks, going home. Let's take a journey. Introduction: A Devil's Bargain. Before the establishment of the National Park Service in 1916, the parks had existed as a haphazard collection of scenic places, occasionally guarded by the Army, often ignored by Congress, and in many ways controlled by the railroads that had funded much of the development in the parks. Stephen Mather, the first director of the National Park Service, was determined to change all of that. He wanted more national parks within reach of more people, and he wanted them promoted as one cohesive system. One for all, and all for one. In order to increase the number of visitors, Mather and his young assistant Horace Albright would ally themselves with the machine that had already begun transforming American life, the automobile. Shout out to Ford and the Model T. Their efforts would bring Americans to the parks as never before, but for some, allowing cars into the parks was the equivalent of allowing the serpent into Eden. While it was an easy decision for Mather, many park supporters worried that he had made a pact with the devil. Looks like we got some spicy controversy stirring in the pot. How's this going to turn out? Mather's mission: attracting visitors to the parks. For Stephen Mather, directing the National Park Service was a noble calling. One so compelling that it had drawn him away from the private industry where he had made his fortune. Just to reiterate, borax is still superior to Tide Pods. While he was known for his intense energy and friendliness, he was also prone to bouts of depression that required hospitalization. In the parks, he found solace and rejuvenation, and he wanted all Americans to experience that healing power. But he realized that until more people started showing up, Congress would never create more parks or even support the existing ones. There could never be too many tourists for Stephen Mather, Horace Albright remembered. He wanted as many people as possible to enjoy his treasures. Mark your calendars for this summer and start planning out that road trip you and your friends slash family keep talking about. Mather and Albright were willing to try almost anything to attract publicity and lure more visitors. They approved golf courses and zoos at different parks, and even proposed Yosemite as an ideal setting for the Winter Olympics. When a new hotel was to be built in Yosemite, Mather arranged for the first charge of dynamite to be detonated via remote control by the Secretary of the Interior, sitting at his desk thousands of miles away. Stephen Mather, what a sensational crowd pleaser, just like that girl. Plus 10 points if you get the song reference. Park superintendents tried to follow Mather's lead in creative public relations. In Yellowstone, Albright arranged for a Buffalo Plains Week, quote-unquote, in which cowboys and Crow Indians stampeded the park's bison herd for arriving tourists. In Mesa Verde, the superintendent's 12-year-old son was encouraged to write a book about growing up among the cliff dwellings. Mather wrote the book's foreword and posed for a picture with the young author. Albright even proposed stringing a cable across the Grand Canyon to allow trams to carry tourists from the South Rim to the North Rim. At the last minute, Mather rejected the idea when he realized it would ruin the view of the Great Chasm. Gotta say, this was probably one of the coolest jobs to ever exist. Public relations and marketing for the national parks? Someone please take my resume. Mather embraces the automobile. It was Mather's decision to embrace the automobile that would have the greatest impact on the number of people visiting the national parks. Even John Muir, Mather's hero, had admitted that the automobile might help create new allies for the parks. But the great naturalist worried that automobiles would mingle their gas breath with the pristine air of the parks. Mather had no such fears. By 1918, tourists arriving in Yosemite by automobile outnumbered those coming by train, 7-1. By the end of 1920, for the first time in history, the number of people visiting the parks exceeded 1 million a year. The automobile, Mather enthused, has been the open sesame. Mather joined forces with automobile clubs, good roads associations, local governments, and car manufacturers to lobby for a national park-to-park highway, linking all the western parks. He believed the scenic highway would pour tourist gold into the communities along its route. I can say from my personal experience that these scenic highways are stunningly gorgeous. During my road trip, there were probably a dozen or so, quote-unquote, sorry for almost killing everyone in the car, moments, because of how blindingly beautiful the views were. In the 1920s, the auto camping craze swept the country, and even President Harding tried out the fad when he joined Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, and Harvey Firestone on one of the well-publicized trips they took each year. Mather took advantage of the trend, urging states to build a network of parks under the slogan, "A state park every 100 miles." Among the people who would be affected by the introduction of the automobile to the parks were Margaret and Edward Gurk, park enthusiasts who had visited their first national park by train. Now that they had a car, they would make full use of Mather's scenic highways. In 1925, Mather staged one of his classic publicity stunts, telling his park superintendents to form a car caravan and travel together to Mesa Verde on the park-to-park highway, generating as much news about it as possible along the way. That year, visitation at national parks topped 2 million for the first time. Stephen Mather, the official head of hype for literally anything that is publicity-related. The Ranger System. Another of Mather's critical tasks was to hire competent people to run the parks. In the past, political patronage had determined who got jobs, with some poor results. Definitely didn't see that one coming. A well-connected employee at Glacier National Park was so inept that his patrols were restricted to following the railroad tracks to keep him from getting lost. The son-in-law of a Mesa Verde superintendent was caught looting precious artifacts from the cliff dwellings. Lots of collective L's being outed here. To remedy the situation, Mather began handpicking new superintendents. He put Jesse Nussbaum, a professional archaeologist, in charge of Mesa Verde. John White, an adventurer and war veteran who had taken a low-paying job just to be at the Grand Canyon, was made superintendent of Sequoia National Park. At Mount McKinley in Alaska, Mather chose Harry Carstens, who had led the first successful climb to the top of the continent's highest peak in 1913, for the most prestigious post of all. Mather chose his own trusted lieutenant, making Horace Albright superintendent of Yellowstone. Putting people in charge of things that have the experience and knowledge to do their jobs properly? Nah, that'll never work. Below the superintendents, Mather wanted a squad of dedicated and professional park rangers. They should be men between the ages of 21 and 40, Albright specified, of good character, sound physique, and tactful in handling people. They also had to be able to ride horses, build trails, fight forest fires, handle firearms, have survival experience in extreme weather conditions, and be willing to work long hours with no overtime pay. From a salary of $1,000 a year, they were expected to buy their own food and bedding, and to pay $45 extra for a specially designed uniform topped by a distinctive flat-brimmed hat. That unpaid internship doesn't sound so bad anymore, does it? Eh? Despite all the requirements, so many men inquired about the ranger positions at Yellowstone that Albright issued a daunting form letter response. If you cannot work hard 10 or 12 hours a day, and always with patience and a smile on your face, he warned, don't fill out the attached blank. Whew. Brutal. The rangers all looked up to Stephen Mather. He once gave a ranger travel money to make a cross-country trip to visit his parents, and occasionally treated rangers and their wives to meals at fancy restaurants. In Yosemite, he spent $25,000 of his own money to build the ranger's clubhouse, and took to staying there himself whenever he visited the park. Mather was so impressed by an educational nature program run by two college professors at a resort at Lake Tahoe that he paid to have it transferred to Yosemite. Soon, guided nature walks and campfire lectures by ranger naturalists were offered in every national park. They became one of the Park Service's most popular programs and promoted the image of friendly professionalism Mather was trying to create. Quick side note, Lake Tahoe is incredibly gorgeous, and everyone needs to check it out at some point. Definitely a little touristy for my taste, but the hiking in the area is amazing. If you're in the area, check out the Carson Pass hike. It leads to the highest peak within a 50-mile radius, and if you ever wondered what it's like to fly in the wild, that's probably the closest you're ever going to get. Although most of the rangers were men, there were also a few women. At age 14, Claire Marie Hodges had ridden horseback for 4 days to visit Yosemite with her family. 4 years later, she became the Park Service's first woman ranger. At Yellowstone, Isabel Bassett Wasson, a Brooklyn native with a master's degree in geology, gave lectures at 3 different locations each day. How badass is that? Way to kill it, Claire and Isabel. To supplement the educational programs, museums were started in each park, with exhibits explaining various aspects of the terrain. Mather himself insisted on wearing a ranger's uniform whenever he visited a park. To boost the ranger's public image, he encouraged Albright to publish a book entitled, Oh Ranger, a collection of humorous anecdotes about life in the parks. Bet there were a lot of poop jokes in there. The race to save the Smokies. Horace Kephart first came to the Smoky Mountains of North Carolina and Tennessee in 1904, and soon started campaigning to save the forests that were being systematically stripped away by lumber companies. He was joined in his efforts to create a national park by George Massa, a Japanese immigrant who spent his time photographing the Great Smokies. Spent his time photographing the Great Smokies. Way to make me feel like a lazy bum. Stephen Mather supported their cause, and in 1926, Congress authorized the creation of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. There was one catch, as there always is. Congress insisted that money to buy the land come entirely from the states or private donations. Local people, churchgoers, hotel bellhops, children raiding their piggy banks rallied to the cause. But it was uncertain whether the required $10 million could be raised before the Great Smokies were completely logged. John D. Rockefeller Jr. came to the rescue when he offered the remaining $5 million that was desperately being sought. But with the Great Depression devastating the country, people were unable to fulfill many of the pledges they had made to create the park. Inspired by the contributions of ordinary people, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt decided to intervene, allocating $1.5 million in scarce federal funds to complete the land purchases. On June 15, 1934, the park was officially established. It was the first time in history that the United States government had spent its own money to buy land for a national park. FDR, what a guy. Colorado owes you big time. An old enemy returns. Mather versus Cameron. Time for that hero versus villain coming of age story I told you guys about last episode. Ralph Henry Cameron had fought against Mather and Albright in their bid to create the Grand Canyon National Park. When he lost, Cameron carried on as if nothing had changed and refused to remove his buildings. Now a U.S. senator, he used his political power to ensure no action was taken against him. Sounds like Mr. Cameron was a pleasure at parties. When Cameron proposed two giant hydroelectric dams and a platinum mine within the park, Stephen Mather set out to stop him and other developers who were planning dams at other national parks. The recently enacted Federal Water Power Act specifically allowed for these dams. Mather, who considered the flooding of Yosemite's Hetch Hetchy Valley to have been a great travesty, was determined that it would never happen again. Bless up John Muir. Mather and Albright wrote memos objecting to the Federal Water Power Act, but they were torn up by Interior Secretary Franklin K. Lane, who was squarely on the side of the dam builders. When surveyors showed up in Yellowstone to inspect the basin for a series of dams, Albright ordered the wooden trail bridges removed so that the surveyors could not cross the rivers. Now that's how being petty is supposed to be done. Meanwhile, Mather galvanized public support through a public relations campaign. The resulting outcry soon put a stop to the proposed dams and all of Cameron's projects in the Grand Canyon. Furious, Cameron denounced Mather on the Senate floor and instigated a congressional investigation. But when Arizona voters refused to bring him back to office in 1926, he finally lost control of his Grand Canyon empire. At Bright Angel Trail, the toll gate was removed so the people who actually owned the park could freely use it. Quite the opposite of Mr. Cameron, Bright Angel Trail is sensational. Definitely go in the morning if you don't want to be cooked by 110-degree afternoon weather, though. Among those who would use the Bright Angel Trail was an adventurous couple whose attempt to travel down the Colorado River in 1928 would end in tragedy. Don't really know why this depressing tidbit was included, but I guess I'll leave it in here as a warning. Don't travel down the Colorado River in 1928. Albright's dream for the Tetons. When he became superintendent of Yellowstone in 1919, Horace Albright made it his personal mission to expand the park southward to include the Teton Range and the valley next to it in Wyoming, called Jackson Hole. He had first seen the stunning series of granite spires and the sparkling Snake River when taking a day trip with Stephen Mather to inspect the progress of a new road. Both men were flabbergasted by the magnificent scenery. Fun fact about the Tetons, because of their absolutely stunning and prominent nature, can confirm because I saw them with my own eyes, they were named the Grand Tetons by a Frenchman who garnered inspiration for the name based on the female figure, if you know what I mean. Back in 1882, General Philip Sheridan had wanted Yellowstone Park enlarged to include the natural grazing range of the world's largest surviving elk herd. The Tetons and surrounding lowlands were an essential part of the elk's migratory home, and conservationists hoped to include them in a greater Yellowstone. The Tetons and surrounding lowlands were an essential part of the elk's migratory home, and conservationists hoped to include them in a greater Yellowstone. As superintendent, Albright promoted his cause to every dignitary who visited Yellowstone. Congressmen, journalists, and two presidents were all taken to view the Tetons while Albright passionately explained his vision. One day, in 1924, Albright learned that the great philanthropist John D. Rockefeller Jr., traveling incognito, was about to visit Yellowstone. Rockefeller's generosity had been instrumental in creating Acadia National Park, and Albright was delighted to learn of his imminent visit, until he received a letter from Stephen Mather asking him not to disturb Rockefeller's privacy by lobbying him about the Tetons. 2 years later, in 1926, Rockefeller returned to the park, and this time Mather did not issue the same warning. Albright took the first opportunity to drive Rockefeller and his wife to Jackson Hole. When they stopped to watch the sunset, Albright revealed his dream for preserving the area. Rockefeller listened in silence. "I felt a little let down," Albright wrote. "Here I had laid out my fondest dream, and there was no word of comment." I imagine this feeling to be similar to reading the infamous words of "thank you for applying, but unfortunately," in an email after applying to literally anything. But Albright's disappointment turned into elation when 4 months later, he was invited to Rockefeller's New York office to discuss the Tetons again. This time, he showed Rockefeller detailed maps and cost estimates for a modest plan to purchase some of the land near Jackson Lake. The philanthropist interrupted, saying his family was only interested in an ideal project. He wanted to pursue the more ambitious dream that Albright had described earlier. Can't even imagine what Albright's face looked like. Probably had to pick his jaw up off the ground. Albright went back to work and soon presented a grander proposal to buy up more than 30,000 acres for over $1 million. Rockefeller immediately agreed to it all. And 2 years later, Congress created a small Grand Teton National Park. Albright and Rockefeller were disappointed that the boundaries included only the eastern front of the mountains themselves and none of the surrounding valley. Rockefeller continued quietly buying up the land, giving Albright hope that his dream might one day be realized. Rockefeller Center is pretty cool, but the Tetons are definitely way better. Thanks, Mr. Rockefeller. Highways with a View. In 1928, yearly visitation at the national parks topped 3 million for the first time. "The parks have been democratized," Stephen Mather declared, and in many ways, he was right. Park visitors no longer came exclusively from the upper classes. They now represented the new, expanding, but predominantly white, middle class. Americans with their own cars and more money in their pockets. Shout out to creating baseline diversity. Congress, too, seemed more willing to support the park system. It more than doubled annual appropriations, although most of the money was for improving roads to accommodate the influx of car-driving tourists. Mather embraced an ambitious plan to have one major road in each park that would open up its scenic wonders to the motoring public. At Glacier National Park, a road was proposed to climb through the mountains over Logan Pass. Mather took a personal interest in its design, championing a longer, more expensive road that would not detract from the view. The result was the awe-inspiring Going to the Sun Road. I already gushed about this road in the previous episode, but I promise it's worth every second of almost dying while driving on it. From then on, Mather insisted that landscape architects oversee every detail of national park roads. Throughout the system, the entire park experience was being redesigned. Scenic turnouts, rest stops, new maps, and guidebooks were all geared towards the motoring tourist. Yard versus Mather, and the creation of the Wilderness Society. Not everyone agreed with Mather's aggressive road policy. Among the dissenters was Robert Sterling Yard, head of the National Parks Association, a group that Mather had helped create to bolster the parks movement. Yard had worked for Mather to promote the parks, but he now worried that all the provisions for motor tourists were overwhelming the park ideal of providing inspiration and elevation of the spirit. Like John Muir, Yard wanted to keep the parks as pristine as possible. Yard also opposed Mather when Mammoth Cave and Shenandoah National Park were set aside. He felt that they did not meet national park standards. The Virginia site was too small and lacked primitive forests, and no one from the Park Service had even visited Mammoth Cave. Hoping to start a movement to preserve the primitive, Yard joined forces with conservationist Aldo Leopold, forester Bob Marshall, and other like-minded people. They formed the Wilderness Society, and their mission was to protect pristine lands not just from developers, but from the Park Service itself. Now that's a pretty big oof. Mather was not happy to have his old friend questioning his judgment. It was a bitter surprise for him when Yard and the National Parks Association came out against his proposal to enlarge Sequoia and General Grant, now Kings Canyon, National Parks. The death of Mather. So much sadness. I cry, you cry, he, she, me, cry. Meanwhile, Mather could always count on Horace Albright. No one in the Park Service admired Mather more, or was more privy to the director's periodic wild mood swings. At least two more times in the 1920s, Mather was incapacitated by depression while Albright quietly filled in. Again, remember to take care of your mental health, guys. In 1927, on his way back from inspecting Hawaii National Park, Mather suffered a heart attack. But a month later, he was in Yosemite, hiking to Glacier Point to prove to his doctor that he was back at full strength. Resuming his busy schedule, he went to Mount Rainier to go over plans for a new road, attended the opening of a lodge on the north rim of the Grand Canyon, and checked on the progress of a tunnel being blasted through the sandstone at Zion. On July 4th, 1928, he celebrated his 61st birthday in his favorite park, Yosemite. Of course this man's birthday was on the 4th of July. He was delighted to learn that his efforts to bring attention to the plight of an endangered grove of privately owned giant sugar pines had prompted John D. Rockefeller Jr. to buy the land and donate it to Yosemite. Someone, please cue the sad music. Thank you. Then, on November 5th, 1928, Mather suffered a stroke that left him seriously incapacitated. Albright was sworn in as the second director of the National Park Service on January 12, 1929. A year later, on January 22, 1930, Stephen Mather died. In his memory, a mountain just east of Mount McKinley would be named Mount Mather. An overlook at the Grand Canyon would be called Mather Point. A scenic stretch of the Potomac River would be named Mather Gorge. A nationwide tree planting campaign in his honor would result in Mather Forest near Lake George. And in every national park, the National Park Service erected a bronze plaque with his likeness and these words, "There will never come an end to the good that he has done." And with that, we continue our story in part 5. Thank you guys so much for listening. I apologize for ending the episode with such a downer, but alas, all good things must come to an end eventually, and the life of our hero, Stephen Mather, is no different. I really hope they establish a Mather National Park one day. No idea where or what it should entail, but I think he deserves recognition of that magnitude. Maybe make it the Mather and Albright National Park. Who knows? Anyways, if you guys have any suggestions, please send them my way at zoopediapodcast@gmail.com. I hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and please have a great rest of your day and week. Cheers!